You try to make black holes in string theory, you find you have to do it by using more than one kind of brain charge bound together. And when you do that, you have to count the kind of number of states you get an entropy. But then what we started doing was, we wanted to make the kind of states you get, the kind of geometries you get, when you mix more than one kind of brain charge to each other. And the basic answer we found was that the geometry you expect is not the one you might intuitively think of at first. Even if you try to put all the brains at one point r equal to 0, and you try to make a bound state from a rather large number of brains, the size of the bound state is not very small. It just seems to tend to expand and become rather big. And one thing we want to see today in some detail is, how big does it become? Does it have anything to do with the size of the corresponding black hole? And if it does, in that case, it might tell us that black holes inside their horizons might be quite different from what we had initially thought them to be. So anyway, here's a one slide rundown of what we were doing last time. You could first, of course, like to start with just one charge in your system, and you could just take that to be NS1 and wrap it on a circle. That, of course, doesn't give you any microscopic entropy because there's just a fixed number of states there. It doesn't grow with the winding number there. There's nothing to see in a classical limit of large N1. And also, if you make the metric from that, it seems to have no horizon area. So at least you are consistent. The area entropy coming out from a black hole kind of ideas agrees with what you get from the microscopics. You get more interesting stuff when you go on to two charges, because there you have the NS1 wrapped on the circle, and then the other charge would be momentum running on that direction. And then we had seen what the momentum does is it causes all the strands of the string to separate from each other. And the key reason for that was the string only has transverse vibrations, and if you start making it transverse vibrations, some part of the strand would go here, some part of the string would go there, and they all spread over some region, so the actual geometries become non-trivial over some region in some ball r less than r0. So even though you might write a naive geometry where you might try to put all the two charges at some point r equal to 0, let's say in the middle out there, but that would have zero horizon area, but in fact, those are not the actual geometries. You get geometries which are non-trivial in some region. And as we said, one of our goals is to see what kind of region that is, what are the properties of these geometries, what kind of physics can be extracted from this. So before moving on, I'll just put down here the final answer we had reached last time. So this was the hard and boring work we had done in trying to make the metrics. We had recalled that taking NS1P system, by duality, you can map it to D1 and D5. And we were more interested ultimately perhaps in D1, D5, because that's where we can apply ADS-CFT and get even more information. NS1P, in fact, is what we started with, because NS1 is the elementary string, P is the momentum, and elementary string carrying momentum is the one case where it's very clear what bound states are, and you can simply construct all the geometry. So you must start here, but by duality, you can reach here. And if you do that, just to write down the answer we reached last time, I might as well write the answer in the D1, D5 duality frame, and this was the string metric. Basically, it's made of harmonic functions, H, K, and AI. But these harmonic functions are not like 1 plus something over R square. If F was 0, this X mod square is R square. But in fact, because the string goes a little left or right of its central axis in trying to carry the profile function F of V, F of V was the profile of the string, you find that the actual source is not at x equal to 0, but at various different places, all the places the string actually passes through. So you had these harmonic functions, but given in terms of the string profile, once you know the string profile F of V, you know the geometries completely. So these are all the D1, D5 geometries for all different string profiles F of V. If you count all the F of V, you get the entropy of the system. If you look at these geometries, you should get the corresponding microstates. You get all the size of the system, and we want to compare those two today. So this was the technical stuff, and this was where we reached last time. We now know the metrics of things which are made from more than one kind of charge. The first thing we want to see about these D1, D5 geometries is that they are rather nice. They have nice properties. They actually don't have horizons, and they don't have any singularities. Now, this may not be very obvious from what we had written on the last slide. There we just obtained the metrics by a certain computation. And in particular, you might be a little concerned about part B, because all those harmonic functions did seem to have some singularities, 1 over x minus f mod square. So you might wonder, where at all those places where x becomes equal to f, perhaps there is a singularity. So let's look at that in some detail. But anyway, here is pictorially what we are claiming in these points up here. The Nyle geometry for two charges, of course, went to a singularity at r equal to 0. We are saying the actual r equal to 0 region gets smoothed out. No horizon, no singularity. It's just that for different microstates, you get a different, what we call the actual geometries. But they're completely nice things. We can call this a kind of a cap. So you have flat space far away, a kind of a throat geometry, a throat part which is common to the Nyle geometry, all the naive expectations you might have. But instead of ending in a singularity at r equal to 0, you get all the different smooth caps. How can we understand the fact that geometries are smooth, that they have no singularities? Just to get a little bit more physical feel for these geometries, what we'll do is we'll take a particular D1, D5 geometry, just play with that all through and just make a complete analysis of that geometry, and you'll see these properties coming up. So you could do it also for the general geometry, but for our purposes, it's good enough to illustrate it by just taking a specific geometry, a specific particularly nice geometry, and so that's what I'll do. So again, last time I was rather happy that people were asking questions in the middle, and you should exactly go ahead and do that. It helps me to get the points across much better, and it also lets me know that I haven't put everybody to sleep. Okay, so what's this particularly nice geometry we'll take? As we said, we could take any shape of the profile function f of v, and that would give us a geometry. And so this is what I'll take for f of v. I'll just let it be a uniform helix. A helix just goes up like this. A uniform helix within the covering space, the string is wrapped many times over a circle of length L, but we said for convenience we could unwrap it for us, and then the total length becomes L total, which is wrapping number N1 times L. In the covering space, it's easier to see what the profile is. But in this covering space, we want to give this helix just one turn. So you can see we are taking a rather low momentum harmonic there. In this whole complete string of length L total, we are putting all our momentum into the lowest harmonic, just one turn of the complete helix. In some sense, the simplest thing we could be doing. So in fact, if these non-compact transverse directions are called xi, r equals 1, 2, 3, 4, this is the profile of the string. F1 goes a cos omega v, F2 goes a sine omega v. So the string is describing a circle as it goes up like this, and the other two ones are just kill them. And you can see if I take omega to be 2 pi times this total length Lt, well then this will make exactly one turn of the helix, so I'll just take that. Okay, so the simplest profile to put on a string, a wave in the lowest harmonic going in a circular form up there. Let's see what kind of a geometry it ends up making. Well, so our goal was to compute the harmonic functions from this profile function f of v, and then of course when we stuff the harmonic functions in the form of the metric, we get the full metric. So if we had to compute the harmonic function, the first one was called H inverse. Remember, even though it was called H inverse, it was really a harmonic function. So it looked like 1 plus q over L, and then here's the x minus f mod square. And in this f, at this place I must stuff in the profile we had. So I'm doing that. x1, x2, x3, x4 are my four transverse coordinates. Here I put in f1, here I put in f2, and f3, f4 was 0 anyway. So I need to actually compute this integral. But you can compute it, and if you go to appropriate polar coordinates, r, theta, psi, phi, on this transverse space, in that case this function really cleans up, and it looks like this, 1 plus q1 over r squared plus a squared cos squared theta. In principle, in general, this could have depended on all these coordinates, r, theta, psi, and phi, but right now I'm not seeing any psi and phi there, because we have chosen a particularly simple geometry. In fact, geometry we chose had axial symmetry. Because it has axial symmetry, I don't see this psi and phi coming up. And in fact, the reason we chose such a simple profile with all this axial symmetry was so that we could have something nice and cute to work with. And here's where you see the simplification. Only r and theta come, and it's actually symmetric. And similar way, you can compute the other two harmonic functions. They all come out nice and comparatively simple in polar coordinates. And so let's see at the end what metric we get. Well, this is the metric. I don't really want to see it because I don't want you to see it in any detail, because otherwise you'll stop listening to the rest of the talk. But I'm just going to derive the things, I'm going to mention the things I want you to get out of this. It's not completely obvious the functions r squared plus a squared cos squared theta. It keeps coming all over the place. And this is basically a harmonic function which is, sort of has the masses in it and so on. At infinity, when you go away far away, you can see h becomes 1, f is basically r squared. At long distances, all these 1 over r squares fall off, h becomes 1. And one can see with a little bit of effort, this goes to flat space at infinity as it should. But in fact, we are more interested not in what happens far away, but what happens closer to r equal to 0. And so that's what we want to see. Just a little piece of notation. When we start with the profile function f of v, we are always talking about ns1 and p, and that has charges q1 and qp, the one-way charge and the momentum charge. After dualities, we reach d5, d1. The ns1 part became d5 and the p became d1. If you recall the dualities we had done explicitly on the screen last time. After dualities, I'll just start calling the q1 as q5 because it becomes d5 charge. I'll start calling the qp q1 because it becomes a d1 charge. So I hope that doesn't cause any confusion. If I'm talking about the d1, d5 system, I'll call the charges q1, q5, and that's why you see q1, q5 come up here. If I'm talking of the NS1P, I'll call them Q1, QP. But they're really the same thing. Okay, so we have a metric here. It's a very explicit metric. And so if you want, you can have fun with that metric. And this is what we want to do with it. So as I said before, if you go to R large, R going to infinity, it is flat space. But in fact, we were interested in R, which is not going near infinity, R, which is in the near region. And then in fact, the metric simplifies, obviously. And it looks like this. So just run your eye over a few of these terms here. Here's the dt square. It factors off from everything else. Here's the dy square. Y is the s1 direction on which we are wrapping the brains. Here's the dr square. Okay, that's the radial coordinate. D theta square. Okay, that's one of the angular coordinates. This psi guy is mixing up with the y to make a d psi minus dy whole square. Looks dirty. The phi is mixing up with the t, you get a d phi dt whole square. That looks a bit dirty. Where are these mixings coming from? Well, because we actually gave the whole string a rotation along a helix, it carries angular momentum. And if you have angular momentum, there should be a cross term of time with one of the angular coordinates, and that's what this is. The phi was the angular coordinate, so you saw a d phi dt. Because it's a string and everything depends on v, which is a function of t minus y, anytime t does something funny, y also wants to do something funny. So they both became little mixed up terms. And this was the torus, the t4, which is not of any particular relevance to us right now. But anyway, if you look at this, you can imagine you'd like to do the following coordinate change. You might want to define a psi prime, which is psi minus this number times y. Then this would become just d psi prime squared. And similarly, you'd like to define phi prime, which is phi minus this number times t. So this would become d phi prime squared. And one can check this is an allowed transformation. When variables are periodic, you've got to be a little careful with that. But this is an allowed transformation. I spent some time just talking about a simple coordinate transformation because this later on in the next lecture is going to become very important. This transformation actually has a physical meaning, and the meaning is it will actually correspond to what is called spectral flow in the CFD. Here it just looks like a coordinate transformation, and one of the beautiful things that happened here. What is spectral flow in the CFT, which changes some states to other states. When we come to that in the next lecture, I'll mention what really is for those who don't know about it. But in this geometry, it is just a coordinate transformation. So anyway, if you make this coordinate transformation, right now all we care about is simplifying the metric. We don't really care about the physical meaning of that coordinate transformation. But if we do that, then this is what the guy looks like. And this time I do want you to look at the metric and to try to recognize what we've gotten here. So in fact, I just made some little rescalings of coordinates to clean it up, and then it looks like this. So here's the metric. Let's start with this piece as simple as the torus, just a finite size torus, and that's the T4, and there I drew you a little square for the T4. This part also you can recognize. This is just the metric on an S3. D theta square, D psi square, D phi square, it's an S3. There I wrote S3, and there I drew you an S3 here. Note that everything now is orthogonal, so there is no mixings anymore. But now if you look at this, perhaps you can recognize this also. R square plus 1 dt square, r square dy square, and dr square over r square plus 1. So what is this? This is just global ADS3. But global ADS3 is a very nice space. It just looks like the cylinder, and there's nothing bad inside the cylinder. It's completely smooth, let's say, at r equal to 0 in particular. There's nothing more nice and smooth than global ADS3. So there it is. And so the whole geometry has become a simple direct product of ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. And now you realize that inside there's no horizon. Of course, in principle, we should look for horizons by looking at the full geometry, but it's quite easy to prove that also. But certainly there's no singularity. Everything seems to have magically gone away, and we want to come back and see how that happened. If you just look at those D1, D5 metrics properly, far away they were flat space, and nearby After a coordinate transformation, they simply look like the most smooth space you could ever imagine playing with. So let's see what the lesson is here. These geometries seem to have no horizon, no singularity. We've seen that by using one particular metric, but in fact the result is completely general and true for all the metrics we could have made from all kinds of profile functions. The metric we just played with right now, in fact, was seen earlier in related contexts to do with black holes. In fact, in the work of Svetich Yom, who tried to make metrics for all kinds of charges and all kinds of rotations. In fact, now we have some very particular metrics where we want to keep only two charges, we want to make them extremal, and so on. But by taking the limit of the general Svetich Yom solutions, you can find this metric there. But in fact, now what we realize is that this metric is actually one of a general full parameter family of metrics, which are parameterized by a function f of v. And what is remarkable is that if you look at all of those metrics, not just the particular one we looked at just now, in fact, they're all non-singular, as Maldacena Maus showed in O2. In fact, this particular singularity you have, which is singularity we were worried about, x minus f mod square, what happens at the places where x becomes equal to f? Shouldn't there have been a source there, a source for everything at some place? Shouldn't there have been a singularity there? In fact, it turns out it's just a coordinate singularity. It's the same coordinate singularity that you get at the center of a Kaluza-Klein monopole. So for people who are not completely familiar with Kaluza-Klein monopoles, you can in fact take S2. On S2, you make a fiber of an S1, and if you make a fiber appropriately, the whole thing is such that you get something which is completely smooth. So you have a radial coordinate, an S2, and an S1 fiber over it. That makes a KK monopole. And in fact, the whole geometry is completely smooth. In certain coordinates, which are good for asymptotically flat physics, the KK monopole geometry does appear to have a singularity, but it's only a coordinate singularity, and when you go really to the center of the KK monopole, one finds the geometry locally is just R4. So if you want to see details of how this is actually turns out and what the coordinate transformation is, which shows you it's a KK monopole, it is actually worked out explicitly in this review notes, which I told you about last time, and so I won't do the details here. The point we want to just draw from all this is that all the metrics we have are completely smooth, and they have no horizons. And so in the D1, D5 language, we just have metrics which are flat space, a throat, and then a smooth gap. That's interesting, and we are going to get some lessons from that. In fact, from this, we are going to find some lessons, some rather interesting lessons about the whole meaning of ADS CFT duality. Yes? Okay, the metric I just wrote down here, which gave ADS 3 cross S3 cross T4, was made with a very specific profile where we had a single turn of the uniform helix. But otherwise, we have metrics for arbitrary profiles, and all of them are smooth. So it looks like a KK mono. It's not going to be global ADS 3 cross S3 cross T4 at all. In fact, it's going to be quite complicated and dirty. As you know, far away it's flat space. In this uniform throat kind of a region, before you get to the messy cap region, it looked like locally ADS3 cross S3 because far away it's just like the naive geometry. But when you get to this cap region, it's nowhere near ADS3 cross S3. In fact, what is happening is the S3 is mixing up very badly with the ADS3. You saw all those cross terms, d psi, dy. You're mixing up the dt, d phi. You're mixing up things like time with the sphere. So in fact, the S3 and the ADS3 are all mixing with each other. And that's an interesting point because in general, if you want to see where all the entropy is hiding in the system, the entropy comes from different profile functions f of v. If you look at the naive geometry, there is the radial coordinate, and then there's the sphere. But they are directly tensor produced with each other. The sphere is not mixed with any of the other coordinates in the ADS3. So the r, the t, the y just go down like this, and the sphere sits separately. But in fact, when you get to the actual caps, the way the whole thing is able to smoothly cap off, instead of actually hitting some kind of a singularity where you might think the matter is sitting, the reason the whole thing is able to smoothly cap off is because the sphere twists over these other coordinates, in particular over the S1 made by Y, and the S3, which was the angular S3 of the whole geometry, and the S1, where all the brains were supposed to be wrapped, the S1 becomes non-trivially fibered over the S3, and the whole thing can completely then cap off into a smooth geometry. And that process where the S1 and S3 mix with each other, in fact, locally as you go around the singularity at each place, is the same magic which happens at the center of a Kaluza-Klein monopole. Yes? Okay, so yeah, that's a good question. You take any profile function f, there will be no singularity unless, well, here's the f profile going up. The transfer space is four-dimensional, so you can project that whole thing down to give a shadow on this four-dimensional space. That's the place over which this potentially dangerous curve, x equal to f of v, is running. It's a single curve in four dimensions, so it has no logical reason to self-intersect. But if you, for some reason, forcibly took it to self-intersect, at the place where it self-intersected, you would get a singularity. Okay, but a generic profile is not going to self-intersect, and so if you just take self, if you do make it self-intersect, it's a limit of smooth geometries. Yes, so if you have a profile which for some value of v then stays at the same location, it will give a singularity at that location because in some sense you could say the first part of that straight line is intersecting or staying at the same place as the next part of that straight line. But again, these are all limits of smooth profiles, so you can just take a smooth family and you can go to these limits. Presumably in the full quantum theory, because you have to make a modulized space with little wave functions and things fluctuate, it would not be a serious singularity. Okay, so let's see what we want to do with all this. Now that we have seen these smooth geometries, we want to come back and ask the physical question, how big is this region over which all this mess is happening? Our two-charge bound state has swelled up a little. It has become not point-like, but how big is this non-point-like object? So again, if this was a nice geometry, that would be created by something which really was point-like, sitting at r equal to zero. But in fact, now we have said we have these smooth caps. You know, different caps can do different things. That's what I try to draw by doing this. But all these geometries are basically the same here, flat space. They are same up to here. And then in some region around here, they start differing from each other by order unity. So suppose I want to draw myself a little border out here. Of course, I can't draw it very precisely because I'm just saying where they start differing by order unity, that has to be always a little imprecise process. But suppose I do draw such a border out there, that's like saying that all these regions where things were a little messy, geometry was complicated, I'm just trying to draw a border out here. This is the physical space. Here I'm trying to draw the whole geometry for you. But in any case, the question I want to ask about this is, suppose you cut this geometry off here, so the whole geometry is like this. This part is common to all the geometries. Here they start differing. I chop it off here. Well, even though none of these geometries had a horizon by themselves, if I chop the whole throat out there, of course, I have a little hole out there. I have a little surface out there, a boundary. And I could try to ask if I measure the area of that boundary and divide by 4g, does it mean anything? In actual space, what I'm saying is if I had a point-like object, which I don't really now because it's become swelled up to some region, if I draw a boundary which is bounding the region where all these typical geometries differ from each other, and I try to compute the area of that boundary and divide by 4g, what do I get? Well, of course, because I'm writing A over 4G all the time, you know what I'm going to get. I'm going to get something to do with the entropy. But in fact, let's just spend a minute before we go to that, the numbers. Let's just see why this kind of a truncation might be physically relevant. This is just an off comment. I don't have any deeper understanding of this. But in some rough sense, you could say this kind of truncation where we chopped off the geometry here and opened up this horizon is a kind of coarse graining. Because what is coarse graining in statistical mechanics? If you had a gas in a box, if you want to just do a coarse graining, what you keep in mind are the parameters which are common to all the different microstates where the atoms could be in different positions. So you keep fixed, let's say, the total volume, the total energy of the gas. But then you discard all the little differences which differentiate between different microstates. So whether an atom was here or here, you try to ignore those differences. And that's a little bit of what we've done here. We've kept that part of the geometry which is common to all the microstates, and we basically try to discard the part which is makes the microstates differ from each other. Anyway, that's just a little one line of philosophy I want to stuff in there. I had nothing more to do with that philosophy. We just want to compute the value of this A over 4G and see what we get. Well, to do that, I have to, of course, look at a typical state, because some states could have a very large size, some states could have a very small size, but it's a generic state whose size I want to measure. It's, after all, a thermodynamic kind of average. Before we can understand the generic state, why don't we first look at the limiting cases so that we can understand what really sits in the middle. And so first you could think of one limit, I just call it limit A, where suppose you put all the momentum, this is now the string, the NS1 string carrying the momentum P again, the vibration profile, you could put all the momentum in the lowest harmonic. So you can see it's the lowest harmonic, just one turn of the string, the kind of thing we were doing before in making that specific example we talked about in some detail. So again, you recall the basic relation was, if you have MI units of the kith harmonic, this is the total amount of momentum on the string, and that must equal N1 NP. We had this basic formula. So now I'm saying we put everything in the lowest harmonic, so the harmonic number K is 1, and then I need to have N1 NP units of that harmonic. So if you actually want to put a given amount of momentum on a string, but you're only allowing yourself to use the lowest harmonic, in fact, you'll find that you must use a pretty large amplitude. Because in fact, you can see there are large numbers of quanta there, you need a large number of quanta of that harmonic to make up the total momentum. So in fact, the string would go quite a bit left or right of itself. The whole thing, therefore, projected down to actual space would really swell up. And so I just call it here big size. If the whole thing becomes rather big, what effect does it have on the actual geometry? Again, flat space far away, you're going down the throat. If the whole thing was a zero size, this was a naive geometry, so I do it by the dotted lines. But at the place where the size of the whole thing comes in, well, that's where the throat gets cut off. So in fact, it's quite a short throat. Quite soon after you reach this rather large size, the whole thing just gets chopped off and becomes a smooth geometry, which we had explicitly as a metric on one of the earlier slides. This thing with k equal to 1 is what we had explicitly made. This is the part which looks like global ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. And the full geometry you can just think of as global ADS3 then just going over to flat space, which is what it's doing, global ADS3 turning over to flat space. Well, here's the other limit that you could try. You could take one quantum of the highest possible harmonic you could use. Again, your law is MIKI should add up to the total amount of charge N1 NP. But suppose you took the highest possible harmonic N1 NP, KI itself equal to N1 NP, then you just take one quanta of that and you are done. And here's a picture of it, very high harmonic, but only one quantum of it though. It carries the same total momentum, but then all the amplitude of vibration is rather small. And so if you just see in what region is differing from being exactly at R equal to 0, it's a very small region. And so I'm just calling it small size. There was a question. You mean here? Here? Yes. Yes, it's awful, that's why, it's absolutely awful. So this is, if this was a generic state, I would worry about it. But since I'm simply trying to show what the extreme states looks like, I agree it's highly messed up there. Okay, I'm not gonna do anything with it. Yeah, absolutely. So it has a very small size, and so in fact, you follow this throat down almost to the point where it could have been the naive geometry. Naive geometry would have gone all the way to R equal to 0. Now you cap off over this small distance, so in fact, you have a very long throat, and the guy looks like this. And here it could be very quantum and very fuzzy, because we had just one quantum of a vibration. It's not a very classical state. This is a very classical state, because you have a large number of quanta in a given harmonic. So that, in fact, just coming back to comment again on that question, the time when you get a nice classical geometry is when in each harmonic you have a large number of quanta. Because after all, each harmonic of a string behaves like a harmonic oscillator. When does a harmonic oscillator behave classically? When you can make a coherent state in it. But when can you make a good coherent state? When you have a large number of quanta of excitation of the harmonic oscillator. If you have just one or two quanta, there are these wave functions which you know, these Hermite polynomials and times a Gaussian. But then if you have large number of quanta, you can make a classical bomb swinging this way and that way, and that's the coherent state. So in fact, this would be very classical, and as we just commented, this would not be very classical. But in any case, each of these two kind of states are rather extreme, and only one state of each kind. If I put all the thing in the lowest harmonic, I just know how many quanta I can take. If I put all of it in the highest harmonic, I also just get one quanta. There's only one state of each kind, so in fact, the generic state, which is where the entropy comes from, must be somewhere in between, and you can work it out quite easily what generic state looks like. And the generic state has this kind of a behavior. Again, we have to satisfy the relation MI times KI should add up to N1 NP. In a generic state, KI turns out to be neither 1 nor N1 NP. Those were the two extremes. The KI, in fact, is a geometric mean root N1 NP. And you can see then to make this relation, the MI must be of the order of also root N1 NP. So in fact, the profile will look something like this. There's some harmonic order k, some number of quanta, you get some profile like this, and you can draw this plot and you get some size R0. And since we had the metric out there explicitly, you can plug all this in, and you can compute what R0 is. And with that R0, you want to compute what's the area of this particular boundary and divide by 4g. You can see it doesn't look particularly nice individually up here or down here. Up here you get Q1, QP, L. L was the length of that S1. V was the volume of the T4. You see alpha prime, the string tension, also there. And then the Newton's constant G has G square and alpha prime all in it also. But then, very remarkably, it all cleans up, and you get root n1 np. As we had said last time also, the times when there are so many parameters in here, all these moduli, the length of the s1, the l, the volume of the t4, the v, and the g, and so on, these are all moduli. And the times when all these nicely cancel out of a formula, that's when you start thinking that you might have discovered something which is basic to the whole system. And in fact, this time you get root n1 np, which in fact is the same order. Up to a factor of order unity, we obviously can't fix it because we don't know exactly where to draw this line, but you get the same order as the microscopic entropy. So what have we seen here? I just said that all moduli cancel out. But the nice thing about computing the area, and again, the area is in the Einstein metric, so I wrote AE up there. Area in the Einstein metric upon G, in fact, is invariant under duality. So once you've done this for the NS1P system, if you like, it's also true for the D1, D5. So the size of D1, D5 bound states, if you draw a border around them or you cut off the throat where they are differing, any way you like, the area of the surface that bounds them is going to be such that if you divide it by 4G, you will get the entropy. It's not immediately obvious, though, that if you take area in the Einstein metric and divide by G, it's a duality invariant. Okay, there are a lot of other things, for example, which are not duality invariants. For example, if you took the area in the string metric and divide by G, it would not be invariant under dualities. But anyway, you can check this in a couple of lines. The area in the Einstein metric upon G is duality invariant, though individually, of course, all lengths and also G changes under all dualities. For example, G has little g, under T duality, G will change. Under S duality, G will change. But in fact, its ratio doesn't change. So this is a nice invariant thing to look for. In any case, that's what Beckenstein had told us to look for. And we find it gives us the microscopic entropy. And as I had said before, there are many other effects in these systems which do depend on duality. So if you, for example, look in the NS1P frame, and here try to look at it in the D1, D5 frame, all the geometries, of course, start differing at some place. But if you look at the same place where the geometries start differing from each other by order unity, if you compute the curvature of the string metric, you find its order 1 over alpha prime. You might worry about the fact that stringy effects are important there. You try to do the same for the D1, D5 system, and you compute the curvature at the same location, the geometries start differing from each other. And in fact, the curvature is rather very low, because in fact, as you know, for D1, D5, the geometry, before you get into this complicated cap, is just ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. What's the curvature of ADS3 cross S3? Both the ADS3 and the S3 have the same curvature, it's RADS. Now, you know RADS is something like N1, N5 to some power. That's a very low curvature. The curvature in the D1, D5 frame doesn't diverge at all, and in the NS1P, the curvature starts becoming larger, becomes string scale here. But actually, it's not the curvature so much which is changing. What's happening is, in this case, the dilaton is going to zero, and the string length is becoming very long. If you think of Planck length as your basic unit, which is more important for anything to do with black holes, because black hole entropy is area measured in units of Planck length squared, if dilaton goes to zero, the string length is becoming very long. The strings are becoming very long and floppy, and in the NS1P system, the string length becomes comparable to the whole size of this ball region, while in the D1, D5, nothing like that happens at all. In any case, we are measuring something which is a complete duality invariant. That's what Beckenstein told us to focus on anyway, and it cleans up nicely. So what have we learned from this? The size of these balls to which the charge state has swelled up to is not small. It's not a fixed length like string length or Planck length. It is something which grows with the number of charges, and it actually grows up to fill what you might want to call for this system the horizon size. It just fills up some ball which has a size which satisfies a Beckenstein-type area law. So this, in fact, ties up to what we had said right on the first couple of slides in our first talk here. We are wondering if the size of bound states actually grows with the number of quanta in the bound state as some power of n, and perhaps the power of n is such that the whole thing becomes big enough to fill up its horizon. For two charge states, we see it here. Let's see if we could do this in a slightly related case. One might say, if you just do it once, it might be accident. So let's try a related case. We can still look at the same two-charge system we were doing, but let's look at a two-charge system with rotation. So far, we have been counting all the states of the extremal two-charge system. Take NS1P or D1, D5. Just count all the states, all the extremal BPS bound states, and that was the entropy. But also, you could try to do a slightly different thing. You could try to count all states which have a given amount of angular momentum, J. Well, that's how you might define, for example, a rotating black hole or a rotating system. Suppose you want all states which have only angular momentum, J. Of course, there'll be less such states than the total count of states. And in fact, the entropy on the microscopic side decreases. The entropy before was root n1, n5. With these three factors, we computed this last time. If you only take states which have angular momentum j, the entropy drops to root n1, n5 minus j. So you can see the entropy is going to decrease, and then it goes down. You put j equal to 0, of course you should get back here. But let's see what happens as you start increasing j. What do the microstates look like? As you can see from this, j should not become more than n1 and 5, and that's okay. When you start making the string, because you have a given amount of momentum to put up on the string, you can only actually get a maximal amount of angular momentum and no more. And in fact, you can soon see you get the maximal angular momentum when you take the whole thing to go in a uniform helix, and there's the uniform helix, and then j becomes equal to n1 and 5. You get one term of the uniform helix. The thing we had looked at in detail as a special example of the metric, that's the one which gave global area 3 cross S3. So here the profile of this projected down to actual space would just be a circle. It's something you can see very elegantly also in the supertube language. It's a supertube which is just a cylinder, but the cross-section profile is just a complete circle. And in that case, it carries the maximum possible angular momentum. Now if you make j a little bit less than j max, so here there's only one state. If you want to get maximum angular momentum, you can only make a uniform turn like that. Or in supertube language, you can just take the completely circular supertube. There's just one state, so there's no entropy here, and that agrees with the microscopics. So again, we're getting some agreement of the microscopics over there with these geometries. If you make j a little less than j max, then of course you have to get most of the angular momentum, whatever j you have, by putting some turn on the string. But you have a little bit of energy left over because not all the energy goes towards maintaining this rotation of the angular momentum. So in fact, the string profile could have some wiggles around this basic helix. So you have some extra energy to wiggle around the circular profile. Now if you were to do that, let's see what's the profiles in the actual space when you project down. That was the picture in the covering space. In the actual space, instead of getting just, if you have one maximal circle, you just get a circle if you had maximum angular momentum. If you can wiggle a little bit around that circular profile, you see the profile of the curve now goes a little bit like this when you look at its shadow in this transverse space. And then different possible geometries could have little different wiggles around here like this. So in fact, all the geometries differ from each other only in a little tube around the circular profile region. And so again, following the same philosophy we had last time, we'd like to draw a surface which surrounds the region where these geometries differ from each other. That was our philosophy of coarse graining. You want to surround by a surface the region where the geometries differ from each other, because that's a kind of coarse graining. And all the regions where they're alike, we'll keep that. But this time, in fact, you get a toroidal kind of surface. And if you want to do that, you get this kind of donut, and you could measure the surface area of that donut. And again, you compute the area in the Einstein metric upon 4G for the donut. And after a few cancellations and half page of computation, you find you get root n1 n5 minus j, which in fact is what we had for the microscopic entropy. So in fact, it works in this case as well. Just to add a little comment to this in line with the talk we had on supertubes yesterday by Matthias, because all the issues of spherical versus toroidal horizons had come up. And of course, the supertube game is much more sophisticated because it can handle more than two charges as well. This is a very elementary case because we're just dealing with two charges. But here itself is a little curiosity, which one might want to understand better if there are any analogs of this with the more charges. On the gravity side, if you have a very small amount of angular momentum, in fact, you get a spherical horizon because all the geometries are basically differing in a region of which is ball shaped. If you have a rather large angular momentum beyond some value, which is like n1 and 5 to the quarter, the whole thing separates out to a donut. So, right? So first you get these kind of donut holes, as they call them, just the round balls. And then you start getting enough angular momentum so that the center of the donut opens up and you actually get a ring. And the transition happens around this scale. You can just see that for the microstate geometries. Is something happening on the side of the brain theory, the D1, D5, CFT at the same time, or the NS1P strings at the same time, if you look at that. If the angular momentum is too low, the angular momentum is distributed among all the different harmonics. So you have various harmonics going up the string, and each of them might carry a little bit of the angular momentum to make up whatever total you had was j. But in fact, when you exceed this particular value, you get a phenomenon of Bose condensation, so that all the angular momentum that you need to make up all comes only from the lowest harmonic. So I haven't given you any details of this enough to understand what's going on, but I guess basically all you could carry away from this slide, in case you're interested in looking at this later in some detail, is that on the gravity side, there's some place where you'll go from a ball to a donut once you start spinning it enough. But on the CFT side, something interesting seems to be happening at the same value of the angular momentum. It might mean something deeper about understanding ADS-CFT, but I don't have anything more to say about it right now. Could you ask that again? Is there a fixed value of the transition? Is there a phase transition? Yes, it is a first phase transition because Bose condensation is a phase transition. Right? Of course, these are all phase transitions for finite infinite volumes. I mean, you have the large number here is N1, N5. Okay, of course, N1, N5 is large but finite. So it's a phase transition, but its sharpness is like 1 over N1, N5. Obviously, it won't be infinitely sharp because N1, N5 is not strictly infinity. But okay, that part apart, it is a phase transition. And in fact, the way you get this is you realize that the vibrations moving up the string, which is what we are counting, are a one-dimensional gas of photons moving up a line, let's say. The way you make them carry angular momentum is that you add a chemical potential, which forces angular momentum. And when you add the chemical potential, you start increasing the chemical potential up and up. At some place you find, you get this Bose condensation. So in fact, it is like a phase transition. Okay, so if you want to do something more with it, so far all we have seen is these objects. We have made the metrics, we've seen them swell up, we've seen their size, but that's a little qualitative. Now we want to do something more with these metrics. We want to learn something about these microstates that we have found. What can we do with them? But to make any further progress in this direction, we need to understand the D1, D5 CFT a little better. So I want to spend a couple of slides talking about the D1, D5 CFT. And again, as I said before, you can do the CFT in more detail than you might care to understand at this point. You can make the orbifold CFT and compute correlation functions. It gets a little technical. And you can read those papers if you want to. But I'll just try to keep to here the details which are enough to get us what we want to get. So again, the discussion for the experts might look a little simplistic, but it'll get us what we want to go along for now. So what do we want to understand from the D1, D5 CFT? Okay, so as you guys well know, if you go to ADS5 cross S5, that's a geometry you make from D3 brains, and the CFT dual to that is a D equal to 4, 3 plus 1 dimensional, N equal to 4 super Yang Mills. But the other case where you get the ADS-CFT duality is when you have ADS3 cross S3 cross a 4-manifold, and we have taken the 4-manifold to be T4. And you can get this if you start with D1, D5 brains, which is what we've been doing. And this time the CFT is going to be 1 plus 1 dimensional because the boundary of ADS3 will be 1 plus 1 if the boundary of ADS5 was 3 plus 1. Now this CFT, of course, is very well known because everybody knows and loves Yang-Mills theory. This CFT, even though in some sense it should be easier because it's a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, but it's not so well known. It's not so clear exactly what the CFT should be, but in any case, the properties we want from it, we want to extract now. And to do that, I just want to make a slight detour and talk about something called fractionation. It's a very simple effect, and you'll see it, what it is. It's something just looks like physics 101 after I describe it to you in a few lines. But in fact, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that this is something which is going to be extremely important for how we are going to understand black holes. In fact, if somebody asked me to give a one-word summary of everything I want to say in three talks, I would simply utter one word, and I would say fractionation. Now, that would become clear only in the next talk, where I'm going to use the idea of fractionation and try to argue that because of this effect, if this is the basic effect because of which all objects tend to get a size which grows with the number of brains in the object. That's basically the final thing we are driving at. As you increase the number of brains in an object, the size of the system grows in proportion to the amount of entropy that the whole thing has. That's the basic goal for everything. But the mechanism by which that happens is something called fractionation, and here it goes. So again, here we have this S1 which we've been playing with all the time. And suppose it's S1 of length L, and you wrap some strings on it. And then if you try to put momentum on this system, you could excite any one of these strings to carry a traveling wave, let's say in that direction, and then the momentum would come in units of 2 pi over L. But that's just arithmetic quantum mechanics. But now suppose you join all these strings up to make this one long string, which is the actual bound state that we talked about. Then of course you can open it up to see what it's really like. It's a string of total length LT equals N1 times L. And now if you want to put some momentum on it, NP units of momentum on this, we saw that the better way to understand that was to say 2 pi N1 NP over LT, because in fact the momentum comes in units of 2 pi over LT. There are N1 NP units, but each of the units individually has a strength 2 pi over L total. After the string has a length L total, the whole wave on the string has to close only after a distance L total. So the basic unit of momentum is 2 pi over L total. So momentum comes in much smaller units. And why is that so important? That's important because basically that gives you not just NP units of momentum to worry about, but N1 NP basic units to worry about. It's good to have more units to worry about because then you can partition a larger number of momentum units among different harmonics, and the entropy becomes bigger. And that's why the entropy is root N1 NP and not just root NP. So it was basic to the whole idea of entropy that this happens. But right now, just notice the fact if you join many strings together, you get a longer string, and the momentum comes in fractal units, not 2 pi over L, but 2 pi over L total. 2 pi over L total is 1 over N1 times 2 pi over L. It's smaller than 2 pi over L. Much smaller if N1 is bigger. And so here is the moral. If you make a bound state, when you bind N1 of these NS brains together, then the momentum charge comes in fractional units, 1 over N1. Okay? It's important you bind them. If you don't bind them, the momentum charge still came in units of 2 pi over L. There was nothing like a fractional unit of momentum. But if you were to bind them to each other, then in fact the momentum comes in fractional units. It's a property of bound states. In string theory, you can see all of stringiness has sort of gone in here. But all this still looks like physics 101 because you could go home, take a rubber band, wrap it around a circle, and you'll see all this happening. How could this be something deep enough to teach us something about black holes? By itself, it does look like physics 101, but it becomes rather more dramatic when you pair it up with the fact that in string theory, you have duality. But duality, you can change, take any charge and convert it to some other charge, and take this particular thing in, for instance, you had NS1 and P, suppose you had N1 units of the NS1, NP units of the P, just like we said. And so in fact, when you bind them together, you get N1 NP units of the fractional P. That's what we saw on the last slide. But suppose I do these dualities we talked about last time, and the NS1s become D5s. I'll just say the N5 of them. As we said, we'll change notation. When I have D5 brains, I'll call the number N5. But N5 is really the same as N1. And if I, the P guy went to these D1s, and I had NP of them, I'm just calling that number N1 now. So I have a D1, D5 system. But then what happens to this effect written out here in the black font? What happens to that fractionation when you go on this side? If you were to just take what happened here and replace the words NS1 and P with D1 and D5, you find you should get N1, N5 units of fractional D1 brain charge. What on earth does that mean? A D1 brain, of course, is like a rope with a certain amount of tension. And if you were to make a fractional D1, it would have to have a fractional tension. It's as if you can take a string and you can cut it up into thinner strings. Well, if you can cut a string up into thinner strings, you can make objects which have much lower tension. The natural objects in string theory all have a tension, which is like Planck length or string length. I'll call those the same scale. But then if you cut them up into thinner pieces, and you can cut them up into any amount of fractions, let's say 1 over N5 in this case, the D1 brains will come with a fractional units of 1 over N5. Just like these came in fractional units of 1 over N1. If you keep making N5 bigger and bigger in trying to make a big black hole, you can make D1 brains which have tension, which are Planck scale upon N5, smaller and smaller and smaller. If you can make objects of very, very low tension, you might imagine, and right now we're being very qualitative, we'll see a detailed way of playing with this in the next talk. But in fact, if you can make things which have a very low tension, you might imagine roughly the thing will be extremely floppy and can go very far. And therefore, this is ultimately going to be the reason why objects, when you bind many, many kinds of brains together, the way you bind them would give you a large entropy, but at the same time, would generate very light excitations, which can actually go very far. And possibly, I would like to think, though I can't prove this, this might be at the source of all these large swelling up of these microstates that we are finding. In any case, for our present purposes, all we need to see is the following. If we just had N5 equal to 1, one NS5 brain, we played with that last time in trying to understand the entropy of three charge black holes. And if I have N1, D1 brains, there'll just be N1 lines bound to it. This is the picture from last time. We drew the T4 like this and the S1 like this. The 5 brains were wrapping all the directions. The 1 brains were only wrapping the S1. But if I have N5 greater than 1, then in fact we can see from here, I'll have N1, N5 units of fractional D1 brains. And so I tried to draw you N1, N5 fractional units here. And the fractional D1 brains are drawn in blue line. And so I get N1, N5 fractional pieces of some kind of a string. I don't want to use the word D1 for it anymore. I just call them components of an effective string. It is something coming out of the fact that the 1 brains and 5 brains have bound to each other. And if you want to understand what happens to the CFP of D1, D5, you have to understand what happens when one brain binds to five brains. It's a difficult job to understand that, and we're just trying to arrive at some kind of a hand-waving model for that, which would be good enough for us to go on right now. Just using the idea of fractionation, we have realized that perhaps the thing to do is to say that not that you have N1 strings or N5 brains or whatever, you get N1, N5 units of something, just like happened in the case of NS1 and P, because after all, this is just duality. Well, if you have N1, N5 units of this effective string, after that, there is nothing to say about it. If you just have a string, the dynamics of a string is very simple. What can you do with a string? Well, you can vibrate it. And the vibrations can go up the string, down the string, at the speed of light, and that's it. A 1+1 dimensional CFT, the hard part was just understanding what the CFT actually contains. But in fact, you have N1, N5 strands of a string, but the string by itself, there's nothing much to say about what it does. Its dynamics is very simple. Its dynamics is much simpler than what you would have if you're doing Yang-Mills theory for the case of ADS5 cross S5. Just a string can carry massless modes running up and down. It's a conformal field chain 1+1. The left movers don't even see the right movers. They just move in their own respective directions at the speed of light. There are 4 bosonic vibrations. We talked about that last time. The guy vibrates in the torus. By Suzy, there are 4 fermions. The central charge for this is 4+2. Fermions count as 1/2, 6. So for each piece of the string, C is equal to 6. Okay, so you just have 4 bosons and 4 fermions running up and down a 1-dimensional line. The only important thing is that 1-dimensional line, there are N1 and 5 copies of it. That's all that we got from all our study of the bound state. There are N1 and 5 copies of that string, but apart from that, it is just a vibrating string. If that's what the D1, D5 CFT is, it's rather easy to play with, and let's play a couple of games with it. Here's the first application I want to talk about. As we said, there are N1 and 5 strands of this string. This orange thing just represents the fact there were 5 brains wrapped on the T4 cross S1. That's the S1, that's the T4, the 5 brains wraps everything. But in any case, the bound state of the 1 brain and 5 brains have made these N1, N5 strands. So what can you do with these strands? Well, you could take all these strands and you could join them up into one long loop. The simplest thing you could do. And then what is the total length of this long string? It will be N1, N5 times this length L. Well, for 2-charge systems, when you were playing to find the entropy, we had gotten an answer, 2 pi square root of central charge upon 6, N1 NP. And where did these two numbers come from? The NP came from the amount of number of units of momentum we put on the string, and the N1 came from the fact that the string itself was long, its total length was L total equal to N1 L. So if the length of the string comes in here, amount of momentum comes in here, they get multiplied together, and that's how you get the entropy. If you want to play with a 3-charge system now, the 3-charge system has these N5 brains in addition, and last time we had just played the game with 1 NS5 brain, but now we have more than 1 NS5 brain, and all we have learned is when you have more than 1 NS5 brain, the string basically becomes a bit longer instead of being having length N1 times L from N1 D1 brains, it gets chopped up into something which is N1 N5 L, because there are more strands. So in fact, what I'm gonna do is, the number of units of momentum is still NP, but the length of the string is not N1 L, it's N1 N5 L, we just said that. And if I plug that into the same formula, you remember C was equal to 6 for this, the modes running up and down the string. In fact, you get this number, and that's the entropy of the 3-charge black hole. So you just come back and fix the little hole we had left in our last talk. Last time we hadn't said how we get N1, N5, NP. We had just put N5 equal to 1 and argued it must come in there by symmetry. But now we see a little bit how it does come in. Okay, so in fact, we're just getting a little warmed up on how to play with these strings. And again, the physics is very simple. If you have these effective strings, all you can do is vibrate up and down, send vibration modes up and down the string. Second application, and now we are getting closer to the kind of things that we want to do with it. Let's just look at a D1, D5, and let's even forget putting any momentum on it. If you put the momentum, it'll become a 3-charge system, and 3-charge systems we are going to talk about in the next lecture. So again, here's the story. We have N1 and 5 units of winding. We said that. That came because the 1 brain and 5 brains, when they bind, they made N1 and 5 units of this fractional string or whatever the effective string we called it. And now there are many ways in which you can make states out of this. You could join them all up into one loop. You could keep some loops. You could have all loops separate. You could join them all up into one loop, some small loops and some longer loops. The only invariant fact is the total winding number must be N1 and 5. So you could just have one loop with winding number N1 and 5. Or you could have many different pieces. The total winding number should end up to be N1, N5. We'll just use the language component string to describe any one of these pieces. Okay, I don't want to call it a string. It's wrapped many times and joins up to itself, but I don't want to use the word string because, of course, it's not a string. It's something which came out as an effective object from the bound state of 1 brains and 5 brains. It's really a component of the one component of a totally effective string. Just to cut it short, I call it a component string. I hope that language doesn't cause any confusion. But the important thing is, even though component strings might be in different pieces like this or in all the different pieces like this, this is not an unbound state. I had cautioned you very strongly last time that we only want to deal with bound states. And even though here it might look like the different pieces of the component string are unbound, they're not really unbound here because this is not a string by itself. It's all, they're all still bound to the NS5. So the whole thing is still a bound state. These are all just different states, different microstates of the D1, D5 system. How many such states are there? Well, what kind of fun are we having? We are trying to partition this number N1, N5 into different groups, okay? If you want to partition N1, N5 into different groups, that kind of game is familiar to us. Last time when we did partitions of N1, NP, we got the entropy of NS1, P system. In fact, this time if you do partitions of NS1, of this number N1, N5, you know the answer. It'll grow exponentially, you'll get exponential root N1, N5, that many states from the partitions, and so the entropy will become N1, N5. Again, on these component strings, there are four bosonic and four fermionic. There are some four zero modes in left movers, four in the right movers. You quantize them, you get four bosonic and four fermionic states. This actually gives you what were the analog of the four different or eight different polarizations of the strings that we saw last time. Eight different polarizations that we saw last time. And then when you put that in for each component string, then you'll find you get the right entropy. Okay, so now what we have seen, what I want to take from this is the fact that all the different microstates of the D1, D5 system really come like this. You take D5 brains, these orange things, you glue the D1 brains to them, you get effective pieces of the string, but all you have fixed is a total winding number of the effective string is N1, N5, but now you can join it up in various ways, and those are all the different microstates. And then you get an answer, which of course had to be the same as the answer we found for NS1P, because after all, the two systems are connected by duality. But anyway, these are the microstates, and now that we know the microstates in the CFD of D1, D5, we are better off. We already know the metrics in D1, D5. We made them last time. Now we understand the CFD of D1, D5, and we have those microstates. All we have to do is put them together. If we knew which of these microstates in this picture corresponds to which metric, then we can get going. Because then we can play ADS CFD. This particular state of the CFD is this metric. This state of the CFD is this metric. If you knew that, you could play physics on the CFD side, you could play physics on the gravity side, and demand that the answers meet. And then, of course, if you do that, you would learn a lot about what is actually going on with these D1, D5 microstates. So in fact, this is the last hole you need to close with this before you can do anything useful. Which of these CFD states corresponds to which metric? And so the way to do that is the following. Start again with NS1 and P, where the string is given by a vibration profile F of V. As we said, that's the basic way we make all the geometries. And again, this, as you know, this F of V is just in the classical limit. What's really happening is that you have N1 and P units of momentum traveling up the string, and you're just partitioning it among different harmonics. So you have a vibration profile, but if you were to Fourier transform it, that's the Fourier transform language, you have MI units of the harmonic KI. So that tells you how you partition energy among different harmonics is the Fourier transform of this profile function, and the total energy should add up to N1 and P. That's how you get different profiles. But in any case, for any profile F of V, you could Fourier transform it like this if you like, but anyway, for the profile F of V, we know the NS1P geometry. You can dualize it, we know the D1, D5 geometry. All we need to know is this particular profile coming out of some function F of V, whose Fourier analysis has MI units of the harmonic KI, what does it look like on the D1, D5 side? In the D1, D5 CFD, you have different pieces of the component string. Each component string has some winding number KI. If it's wrapped just once, KI is 1. If it's wrapped 2 times, KI is 2, and so on. Of course, they all have to add up MI times KI. If you had MI component strings with winding number KI, the total must be N1, N5. We already said that. Well, then the picture is very simple. If you had MI units of the harmonic KI here, it just translates to having MI units of a component string with winding number KI on this side. It's as simple as that. So once you Fourier transform this F of V and you see which harmonics are populated here, well, that's the length of the strings which you'll find on the other side. So now you know the CFD state. From the CFD state, you know which harmonics are used, so you know the profile function F of V by Fourier transform. From F of V, you can actually make the geometries, and by duality, you get a D1, D5 geometry. So in fact, you finally do know from a given microstate what is the corresponding geometry. This might look a little involved. It's actually not as bad as that. We'll actually just do this with a simple example of geometries in a second, and so you'll see how it works out. When you see it in a given example, it wouldn't look so mysterious. Okay, so here we look at a special subclass of states. That's always a trick to do when you want to understand what's going on. And the subclass we take is the following. Again, it's profile function f of v, which has all the information. Let it be k turns of a uniform helix. Remember, we played with one turn of a uniform helix when we made the particular metric we played with right in the beginning. That gave us ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. But now I'm letting myself have any number k turns of a uniform helix. So the whole thing looks like this. Because it is k turns of a uniform helix, in fact, if you were to Fourier transform this f of v, all the power in this Fourier transform is in the harmonic k. Okay, it's all in the kth harmonic. If it's all in the kth harmonic, what will you find in the corresponding d1, d5, CFT side? All the component strings you get will all be equal and will all have winding number k. So that's it. You put all the thing in the Fourier transform, Fourier component k here, you get all the strings are broken up into things of winding number k. Okay, so in fact, you might think that they all look quite similar. How do they actually differ from each other when you change k around? Well, but k could be anywhere from 1 all the way to n1, n5, so k has a big range in there. And you can see a little bit of the physics, which we are going to come to in the next slide or so by just looking at the differences between these for different k. Suppose k was small, here k is just 2. This is the game we went through before. If k is small, to carry the same amount of momentum, you need a rather large number of quanta. The whole transfer size becomes quite big, and the throat gets cut off when it's quite wide up here. You get a short throat. If you have a large k, you have very high order harmonic. You need a very small number of quanta to do that, to carry the same total momentum. The size is very small. The throat goes much closer to r equal to 0 before actually capping it off. I call that a deep throat. So in fact, you see this here. For small k, you get shallow throats. For larger k, you get deeper throats. But in fact, notice that for small k, you get all these component strings with small winding number. For large k, you get all these component strings with large winding number. Could we possibly establish a link between what we see here and what we see here? If we can play some ADS-CFT games here, we'll in fact get a rather detailed understanding of ADS-CFT, because it's not just one state around which we do perturbations or something. We have a whole family of states on the gravity side, a whole family of states on the CFT side, and state by state, the whole physics should work out. Well, so we'd like to play some Gedanken experiments with this to have some fun. And we'll choose a Gedanken experiment, which has a lot to do with how black holes were played with in the mid-90s. And the Gedanken experiment is the following. You take your D1, D5 states. Again, here's the picture. They all have equal winding numbers, so I've drawn it like that here. And you send a graviton onto the state. So you imagine taking your D1 and D5 brains. D5 brains are wrapped on T4 cross S1. The D1 brains are wrapped on S1. It's a bound state. But as far the transfer space is kept, is concerned, you keep it all at R equal to 0. Okay, it may spread a little bit, we know that. But anyway, you try to put the whole thing at R equal to 0, let's say in the middle of this room. And then from this transfer space, you send a graviton onto it, coming like this, onto this particular bound state, and that's this graviton here. So graviton string theory comes and is incident on this bound state. But what happens when it actually hits this collection of brains? And again, this is the old story of black holes. As you know, if you have a string, and the physics of a string is that it can carry vibrations this way and that way on the string, it's of course no different from an ordinary string of a guitar. If you have vibrations traveling left and right, they can collide, and the whole thing can come out like sound waves into the room. And conversely, if you have a sound wave coming and hitting a string just sitting there, the energy of the wave can be absorbed onto the string, and it will go into one left and one right mover along the string. You can't just have the whole wave going one way or the other because there's no momentum along the string. The graviton just came like this. But anyway, you'll excite standing waves on the string, which basically decomposes into one wave going right and one wave going left. And that's all we see here. The graviton gets absorbed into any one of these strings, and you have one vibration mode going up at the speed of light and one going down. And with a little bit of effort, you can compute the probability for doing this. And let's compute the probability for absorption into the state and call it P sub CFT. CFT because the coefficient of CFT, and P just stands for probability. What are we actually doing on the dual gravity side? Well, this particular microstate we had here corresponded to some kind of a metric like this, flat space far away than the throat, and then there was the cap. The graviton is incident there, the graviton is incident. But then this time, of course, there's nothing for the graviton to get absorbed on. There are no strings to see here in this dual geometry. So what all that can happen is either the graviton actually falls down the throat, or the graviton might just breeze past and not fall into the throat. After all, if you have a graviton coming into this region of space-time, and here there's a deep pit, the graviton might either end up falling into the pit, or it might just brush past the pit and continue. It's just a matter of probability. You solve the wave equation, see what part of the wave goes in and what part of the wave just doesn't go in and just continues leaving, and we'll call the probability of being absorbed into the throat as P supergravity. That's supergravity calculation. And if you do this with some effort, this calculation in fact involves all the wave equation mess, and this involves just some playing with the CFT. Then in fact, when you do this, you find PCFT is equal to P supergravity. So this in fact is an old story. It was played with black holes because people had this model for the D1, D5 black hole, and this was the geometry of the black hole. And because this probability PCFT agreed with this probability P supergravity, one said that one has understood that the absorption into black holes is exactly like absorption into deep brains. And so that in fact brought up the idea that these deep brain black holes, whose entropy we have understood by all the Strominger-Wafa story, in fact, if we now play dynamical games with it, even the games seem to be working out. The absorption to the black hole, probability to fall into the black hole, is equal to the probability to fall into and get absorbed into the corresponding set of D1, D5 brains. So in fact, this kind of analysis was part of what Malthusner used in trying to arrive at the whole idea of ADS-CFT duality. But now if you look at this with a little bit more detail, you find there's a potential difficulty. As far as the CFT is concerned, we had this effector string which had a certain winding number, and once you get absorbed into it, you got left movers going up and right movers going down. As far as the string is concerned, these guys are gonna travel around the string, which after all has only a finite length, and after some time, they're gonna come and collide with each other. And if a graviton would come and make these vibrations, then after all, when these vibrations collide, the whole thing can come off like a graviton. So in fact, the string will re-emit, and that's of course natural for any finite mechanical system. If you can absorb into the system, after a while the guy would like to re-emit back and go back to its ground state. If it can complete a time to do that, the time for these guys to move around the string and collide once again, we'll do that on the next slide, but for the moment, let's just call it delta T CFT. What's happening on the gravity side? Once you fall down the throat, well now you have to ask what's going down at this end. And in the old days of black hole physics, that's not a part we're particularly worried about. Once it fell down the throat, we just assumed it got absorbed into the black hole, just trying to compute absorption cross section. So we didn't worry about what happened to the guy. It basically went in. In fact, if we use the naive geometry of the black hole, because this goes infinitely down all the way to r equal to zero, in fact, doesn't come back. Now that's a little paradoxical, because here in the CFT, the guy comes back after a given time, and here the guy never comes back. Now that is a contradiction if this was the metric. But in fact, we've just argued with all the effort we put in last time and today that that's not the metric. The metric actually has a cap. And if the metric has a cap, once the guy falls in, it's gonna turn back and try to come out. And if you do a calculation of this wave equation, you'll find there's a certain time delta T supergravity after which the guy would like to come back. And so you might want to compute and check if delta T CFT has any relation to delta T supergravity. If it does, then all these caps and all that we have found are really rather good. They were actually needed for consistency, and all the fact we found is geometries to swell up, which gives them the caps and everything, all that is really part of the physics. We need all that, because without that, the whole thing would make no sense. So well, here's the computation. On the CFT side, it's actually a rather simple computation. So again, as we said, we just get absorbed into these little string, and the modes travel left and right. I just opened up the string into a big circle here, but we know the length of that circle. If the wrapping circle has length L, and you wrap k times in this, your winding number is k, the length of this whole circle is just k times L. And so in fact, a graviton comes, it breaks up into a pair of vibrations. One, they go and they meet again here, and they collide, and it comes back like a graviton again. How much time does that take? Well, we said these guys move at the speed of light, but each of them has to move only half the distance around the circle before they collide again. So in fact, the time it takes them to do this, delta T CFT is the length of the string, but then divide by 2, KL over 2. But that's the time after which the quantum would try to come out. What do we do on the supergravity side? We just solve the whole wave equation, delta phi equals 0. You send a wave packet in, you let it reflect from the end, you wait for it to come out, and you find a time delta T supergravity. Initially, it looks like a mess because after all, it's made in terms of quantities which involve all the moduli of the system, the V, the L, the alpha prime, the G, they're all in there. But as we said, when you're doing something which is expected to match very well with the other side, everything cleans up, and it cleans up to give you exactly KL over 2. And so you find delta T CFT agrees with delta T supergravity for each value of K. So in fact, we are seeing something nice here. For as you keep changing K, you're having different states on the CFT side, different states on the gravity side. Some states in the gravity set have short throats, some have deeper throats. In each case, when you play the game of throwing something down the throat and taking it back, whatever time it takes to do that is exactly the time it would have taken on the corresponding CFT side. Because the CFT side, sometimes the component string was short, sometimes the component string was long, but state by state, everything agrees down to the last factor of two. I think this calculation taught me something about ADS CFT. Clear a certain confusion of mine. I was enormously confused about the meaning of ADS CFT all the time since Malcina proposed it. I just couldn't understand this thing. But maybe now I have a little bit better understanding of what ADS CFT might be trying to say. And I just try to put on this slide. It's not a technical slide. I just want to show you what my confusion was and how I would like to understand that in the light of what I think I now understand about ADS CFT. What did Einstein tell us about gravity? Can you take flat space? There's no matter over there. Or if you put some matter somewhere, the matter creates curvature. So this kind of a picture you could find perhaps on the cover of any book on general relativity. Now Malcina came and told us that's not true. He said that the matter of string theory, which is basically brains, they are dual to supergravity. You can either have your matter in the form of brains, or you can have your supergravity, but don't take both. It looks rather funny. Either I take flat space and I put my brains in it, okay, some strings, I just drew them like this as a colloquial way of drawing brains. Or I can take the extra space which I get when I take the back reaction of these brains, and perhaps the local geometry could be ADS if I pick appropriate brains. But then here I'm not supposed to find the brains. I just get ADS. So I either get my matter or I get my geometry, but Einstein was trying to have it both ways, and he can't. I didn't really understand this, because if you start doing this really in this room, you take a stack of brains and you pile them up in the middle of this room. Take D3 brains if you like, and you stack them in the middle of this room, or D1, D5, and you put them there. Well, around them, they'll create some curvature. The space far away, of course, would be flat. That's what I tried to draw here. As you come near the brain, the space would be curved. What happens when the brains were there? Are the brains gone? Very hard to imagine what would happen there. If I actually walked down this throat of this geometry, I went down to where I had put the brains, and I knock on them, will I see the brains there, or will I not see the brains there? What is really ADS CFT all about? Where do the brains go? And this looks enormously confusing. For me, the thing got further confused when Witten told us exactly what to do, because Witten, in fact, slightly changed the problem. He went to Euclidean ADS. That looks like a nice ball. There are no brains anywhere inside it. Not even place which could be singular, like r equal to 0, where there could have been some brains and you don't understand something. It told us we want to compute coefficients in the CFT. The CFT lives on the boundary. Supergravity lives in the bulk. It doesn't seem to relate directly to the question which I would have posed before. If we just put some brains in the middle of this room, far away space is flat, the brains are r equal to 0, there's a metric around the brains. What happens when I go and look at r equal to 0? Are the brains there? Are the brains not there? So here, in fact, the question was slightly altered, and so, in fact, it still didn't answer the puzzle which was confusing me. So again, here the question, what happened to the brains? And in particular, suppose the D brains I put down there in the middle of the room, suppose they could have had many different states. You could have many different microstates of brains. In particular, if you have a D1, D5 system, you don't have a large ground state entropy. All the states have the same mass, but they're all different. There are e to the root N1, N5 states. Which metric will I get from them? If the brains don't sit there at r equal to 0, they can't tell me which state they are in, then who's going to tell me which state they were in? But now we can see what actually happens here. You can make different microstates of these brains. All these components of the effective string could be, let's say, all separate circles, or they could be all one circle. I've just taken two examples, two extreme cases. Both of them have the same total mass, same charge, because how you join strings doesn't change their mass, doesn't change the charge, same total winding number. Metric for this was a short throat, metric for this was a deep throat, but in the throat down there, there were no brains. We saw this was completely smooth. There was no singularity even. There was certainly no matter in there. So how do we find out which microstate we actually had? If you played any physics with this, if you vibrated this string, vibration only would travel for only a short time before coming out. But all that physics is encoded in the shape of the throat, exactly as Malcina wanted it. And if you look at this, again, if you excite this long string, the vibration will take a long time to be entangled in the string, but they can just spend that long time traveling up and down the throat, and so the geometry actually encodes the physics of what the brains were doing. And so, in fact, the crucial thing if ADS CFT were to make sense is that if you have different microstates, the CFT side, they must have had different geometries. If they all had the same geometry, how could the two things be dual? Because on this side, you're not supposed to see the brains anymore, but if you had two different states, you should get two different states here. But in fact, the shape of the geometry now encodes the microstate physics, and that's how ADS safety plays its role. In fact, both of them have the same mass and charge. You might have some rough idea that if you have a bigger mass, you should make like a deeper pit in Einstein gravity. And that is roughly true, but in fact, there are two ways to see how big an imprint of certain mass makes. There's the width of the throat, and then there's the depth of the throat. In fact, in both these cases, the width of the throat, the size of the S3, that's the same. It comes from the charges. But in fact, if you look at the depth of the throat, it actually depends on the details of the microstate. In fact, if you look at more complicated geometries, they'll be even more messy at the tip of the throat. But here we see that, in fact, in string theory, all the physics of this microstate is being put inside the actual shape of the geometry. The geometry really absorbs all the information about the matter. That wasn't true in Einstein gravity. In Einstein gravity, you could take two balls, one made of copper, one made of iron. If they had the same mass, they'd produce the same metric. With ADS CFT, that cannot be, because in fact, the gravity has to be dual to the whole matter. So in fact, there must be some subtle difference between copper and iron, which makes the matter the metrics a little different. And here we have seen, if you actually use the objects which are in string theory, not the copper and iron directly, but strings with different states, they have the same mass, same charge, but they make different geometries. So I think that's a useful lesson to learn about how ADS CFT might work. Let me slightly continue on that track, but answer a slightly different question. We haven't talked much about black holes in today's class. We just played with certain microstates. We threw things in. We got them out. We bounced things off. Played with ADS CFT. Let's now talk a little bit about black holes. We look at these two charge objects, and you might ask, where in all this do you see anything which looks even remotely like a black hole? And here, let's take a look at this and have some fun with it. So far, we are looking at microstates, which all had each of the component strings were the same length. So we did that because we just wanted to do something simple. We gave all of them the same winding number k, and that came because we took a profile of the f function, which was all having all its power in one harmonic k, and that made everything very simple. The geometries were actually symmetric, but now, in fact, a generic microstate, of course, has completely different lengths of the strings. Some are short, some are long. In fact, the distribution of lengths of these strings are the same as distribution of energies in a 1+1 dimensional gas of photons, because we had said that's basically where all this thing comes from. If you go to the NS1P language, the Fourier modes running up and down the string are like a 1+1 dimensional massless gas. They don't all have the same momentum. The momentum or the same Fourier harmonic. The Fourier harmonic is peaked around an average, but with a fair amount of spread, and that's the spread. So generic states have to look like that. And equivalently, therefore, if you look at the profile function f of e, it's composed of many harmonics, and remember the same relation, mi ki has to equal n1 np, or if you convert to the d1, d5 language, the winding numbers ki, is there a mi string, the winding number ki, only total winding number n1 and n5 is fixed. But within that, all these generic unequal lengths are the basic nature of the generic microstate. Well, once all these things are unequal, what do we get? That's the generic state. Let's see what we learn from the generic state. Now, this time, the state is dirty. You can make it, of course, because for every profile function, we wrote down the geometry, so we know the geometries. The geometry doesn't have any nice property like being actually symmetric, for example. There's no actual symmetry. We got the actual symmetry by choosing only the uniform helixes. These guys are dirty profiles, and so, in fact, the geometry at the end is very complicated. It's coming from just reflecting the complication of the profile of the string. So geometry looks like this. And now suppose you take this and you throw a quanta into this geometry. In the case where we had those nice actually symmetric geometries, the quanta came in, the quanta bounced out, knew a certain time of return, and that agreed with the CFT side. Let's see what happens this time. You throw a quantum in, it goes in here. What does it do? Does it just hit this point and come back? It does stay meandering around this point, this region, for a long time. Well, actually the latter happens. It goes in there and it just plays around here for a long time, finally managing to find its way and come out. It's just trapped there for some time. Why does it stay trapped there? Well, you could first do this in a couple of different approximations. If you take this to be just a massless quantum going in, you could use a null geodesic. You already know the metric here. Even though it may look dirty, you know the metric. You could see how null geodesics behave in that metric. And basically what null geodesics do is, every time they come near this crazy string profile, they sort of deflect by a certain angle, which is just pi. They keep doing these weird things. So you just sort of describe a kind of a random walk around the profile of the string, and they get trapped around the string for a long time. And we did a computation where we estimated this time for which you'll be trapped, as delta t trapping. It's connected to the basic time across which you will just, let's say, cross the throat. a classical crossing time across the diameter of the throat. That's a time of, you know, classical time that you might easily see, but multiplied by the square root of the entropy. Square root of the entropy is a big number. It's like 1 over h bar, because entropies for all the systems are 1 over h bar. H bar is a small number. Then in the classical limit, the entropy is infinite. The entropy was like root n1 np. In the classical limit, n1 and np are infinite numbers. So entropy basically goes to infinity. So in the classical limit, this trap in time really looks infinite. You could do the same with wave functions. You could throw a wave function in rather than think of it as a geodesic. And then what happens? Some part of the wave bounces off here and comes back. Some part of the wave bounces here and comes back. But because this wave had to travel a little bit more than this wave, the two different wavelets coming back, they're out of phase, and they interfere destructively, and so nothing comes back. So again, the wave, you get phase interference, and again, things are trapped in the wave picture or the geodesic approximation. In any case, you get trapped in there for a long time, and these trapping times are very long. Is there any analog of this in the CFT? Now, in the CFT, when we had taken all the circles to be equal, okay, then delta t CFT was just a time to go around that string upon 2. You remember the KL over 2 thing, just go around and come back. There was no phase interference from being absorbed onto different guys because they were all the same length. So first they all absorbed them, and then they could all emit them. They were, all the different effects were in phase. Now, if the strings are of different lengths, then you might ask the question, the time to return from the string, if you get absorbed onto this complex of strings, which are all of different lengths, time of return is just given by the average K times L over 2. That would be one possibility. It could be much longer than that. If it's just like the average K times L over 2, it's not so different from this. But that's not the case. But what happens is this. Suppose one string is very short, and here's a short string. It sends some waveform on it. It gets absorbed onto the string. Then the same whole thing collides again, and it comes out. So a certain time delay, which is given by the time to go around the string, the whole waveform comes back. Now it might also go onto a longer string. Now again, this time it has to go around this longer string, collide again and come out, so it comes back with some time delay, it comes out a little later. I should have drawn it on this side. I don't know why I drew it on this side. Anyway, it comes out a little later, not at the same time. And then on this medium-sized string, it also comes out at some other time. So in fact, all this, the same wave function impinging on all of these, and there's some amplitude to go here, some amplitude to go here, some amplitude to go here. So you have to add all these amplitudes, because the return amplitude, some comes early, some comes late. You have to add all these wave functions. But what happens if you take a wave function and you superpose it with its translate and with another translate and another translate, all the different translates? Well, you get phase cancellation. Everything cancels out and nothing comes out. So in fact, what you have seen is, because you have to add all the translates of the wave function, what ends up happening is this function f of t, the initial profile of the wave function you put, if I replace the sum over different strands by an integral, it just gives a zero harmonic in there. And then if you had massless modes which are going only inwards, and suppose the Fourier spectrum was continuous, that basically has to be zero, and so nothing comes out. Now, of course, nothing can stay on that system for all time. I'm not saying that nothing ever comes out. Stuff comes out on a much longer time scale, and that happens because this integral is not really an integral, it's really a sum. We take the difference between sums and integrals, you get a time which is a much higher power of n1, n5. It's a completely different time scale. But certainly it didn't return in the time which you expected. The time of return in the CFT is much bigger than the average k times l over 2, which you might have thought at first. So phase interference prevents you from returning in the average expected time. The different waves just cancel each other, they get in each other's way, and so the whole CFT state looks black. You throw something on it, nothing comes back. We saw that also in the gravity picture. In the throat, something goes in, it keeps meandering around in the complex curve, or if you like, you get phase interference of the reflected waves. Nothing came back in the gravity picture, and we've just seen why nothing came back in the CFT picture. But in fact, if you look at this, this kind of blackness that you throw things in and nothing comes back to you, is exactly the same reason why things are black in the lab. If you take a sphere, which is completely polished, a silver sphere, completely spherical and round, a light wave falls on it, it just reflects right back. And now you take a sphere made, let's say, of charcoal. Well, then when the wave comes on it, all the different grains of charcoal are arranged at different angles. Some part of the wave reflects this way, some part reflects that way. You don't get a nice coherent reflection of the whole wave packet in a smooth way. And in fact, all the wave just gets trapped into the charcoal and it doesn't come out. So in fact, what you see is that blackness of this whole system is really arising from disorder. If all the lengths were equal, the thing just goes on them, it just comes back. On the gravity side, you have a throat, it's actually symmetric, you can solve the wave equation, it just goes, it comes back, there's no trapping. It's only when you have disorder, the whole thing traps things for a long time. It's sort of interesting though, because now we have seen things can get trapped in the throat for a long time, so if you cut off that region where the thing was in this complicated fashion, you might want to call that a kind of a horizon, because if you go past that, you don't return in times which are finite in the limit h bar going to zero. The time of return becomes order 1 over h bar, that's a very long time, and so you might say for a classical observer, it's like a horizon, because you don't come back in a classical time. But it's also interesting that the blackness really comes from disorder, because it connects the idea of a black hole can absorb with the issue of the fact that black hole has entropy. After all, entropy is where disorder came from, and now we're seeing it's black also for a reason, which is similar to the idea of disorder, but apart from that, the black hole is behaving very much like any other classical object. So I'm almost out of time, since I had started maybe 5 minutes later, I'll just take a couple more minutes to summarize a few generic points about black holes, just to close on a slightly more philosophical note this part, and the next time we'll start with free charge geometries and learn about them. Here are a few general comments I want to make on what we have learned through this study of two-charge microstates and how it might compare to how you might otherwise think about black holes, in particular at the moment about two-charge black holes. So here's the first question. Let's look at the no-hair theorem. People always said black holes have no hair, but here if you are finding all these microstates having all these different kinds of shapes, well, they are like the hair. You can see the different microstates. Different microstates have different geometries, but in the past we always said a black hole has a unique geometry. Black holes have no hair. How did the no-hair theorem get bypassed over here? Well, the no-hair theorems work in the following way. Not really theorem, I put them in quotes here. If you have a horizon, then you cannot find a smooth deformation of the horizon. If you actually had a horizon, then in fact, if you try to make a small deformation of the horizon, suppose you try to put a scalar field which is non-zero in the vicinity of the horizon, and you might think that's some kind of a hair because it can change the value of the scalar field. Well, it turns out at the place where you have the horizon and g2t goes to zero, at that place the energy density of the scalar field must diverge. So in fact, you cannot make any finite energy perturbation if you actually have a place where g2t has vanished, so horizon doesn't support any deformations. That's how technically it works out. But in the actual microstate geometry that we have, we don't have a horizon. The GTT becomes small, 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 smaller, but never goes to zero. Just before it was about to go to zero, just before you were about to get a horizon, the whole geometry twists itself and makes itself into a cap. Now, if you never had a horizon, there's no theorem which tells you that you can't have hair. In fact, you get different caps, and they are the hair. Well, that's how it worked out, at least in this case, for the relation between how you don't get hair for normal black holes and why you got hair here. Something about horizons. If you just solve a black hole geometry, people seem to see a horizon. So if you just take this two-charge system and you put in this R-squared corrections we talked about, even for two-charge case with the R-squared corrections, you get geometries with horizons. How are these geometries made? Well, you have your supergravity equations. You add your R-squared corrections if you want. And then you have to take an ansatz, because otherwise the work is a little hard to do. What ansatz do you take? You take a spherically symmetric ansatz. You take a spherically symmetric ansatz, and you solve your supergravity equations, and what do you get? Flat space, a throat, a horizon. What actually happens? If you look at all the microstates, none of them are spherically symmetric. In fact, we saw that as a matter of first principles, if you take the NS1P system, and all of the two-charge systems are made by duality from the NS1P, if you want to put a vibration P on the NS1, if you don't put any P, only have NS1, there's no entropy anyway. You have to put the P. But if you want to put a P on the NS1, you have to make spherical symmetry because the string has to go either left or right, has to do something, it'll never be spherically symmetric. So in fact, none of the microstates have spherical symmetry. Axial symmetry is the best you could get. So in fact, in the spherically symmetric ansatz, you can make the ansatz, you can get a solution, but none of the actual microstates satisfy that ansatz. Okay. So in fact, you can also see that in the D1, D5, CFT, the Fermion zero modes break spherical symmetry, but anyway, I think it's easiest to see in the NS1P picture, there are no spherically symmetric solutions. If you solve the problem with a spherically symmetric ansatz, sure enough, you get a horizon, but the microstates don't obey the spherically symmetric ansatz, and so that's why that particular ansatz may not tell us anything about the actual D1, D5 microstates. And then here's the last point. So what do we say about traditional black hole geometry? somebody has taken the supergravity equations, perhaps put in the R squared corrections if it's a two charge case, and then he took the spherically symmetric answers, and he made a metric, and the metric had a horizon, and inside the horizon was a singularity. If we didn't put the R squared corrections, we just got this thing which was singular at R equal to zero. If you put the R squared corrections, he got a horizon and a singularity. And he says, what do you understand about this metric in string theory? Where is it sitting in string theory? Well, what I would like to say based on what we have seen is, it is not sitting in string theory. So why would we say that? If you had actually shown me by any construction, spherically symmetric or not, a solution which was smooth everywhere, then I have to find you an explanation of that solution. Because even though you would have solved it in classical supergravity, if the solution is completely smooth, even if you add alpha prime corrections, G corrections, there'll be some small distortion of the solution, but there'll have to be some solution, and I have to explain it in the dual CFT. After all, every state in the CFT has to become a state on the gravity side. But if you show me a solution which is singular, or perhaps has a horizon, and once you have a horizon, you always have a singularity inside by the singularity theorem, I don't have to accept this solution. It may not be there in the full theory. For example, you could make solutions with closed time like curves or naked singularities, and we often say, well, you can make those classically, but they, of course, don't have to be in the whole theory. Perhaps even these guys may not be there in the whole theory. In fact, the solutions we have made, though, are completely smooth, all the different microstates, and they have to be in the theory. They're completely smooth. And in any case, we didn't postulate them. We actually derived them from the NS1P, and after that, all the other two-charge systems were connected by rigorous duality. So we didn't make any logical jumps there, even though we didn't put in our alpha prime G corrections in any detail. But at least the solutions we made them rigorously from scratch, and they, in fact, did not end up looking like this. They end up looking like this. So perhaps one can get these solutions, which you get just by making the spherically symmetric ansatz. The interpretation of these solutions should not be, perhaps, as actual microstates of the two-charge system. It is in some kind of a coarse-grained or averaged way that an average over these guys, which must mean what this guy is. This one doesn't exist at all. But this black hole here must be some kind of an average ensemble description of what this thing is. But if that is true, at least everything would be nicely reconciled. You would understand microstates. Microstates, we can make them. They're completely smooth. They don't have horizons. When we average over them, you might define some kind of a horizon. I don't know about the interior very much, but on certain short time scales, it might behave as if it has the classical black hole geometry. But certainly, we shouldn't look at the classical black hole geometry and try to peer into it and try to find the microstates. I think that was the error people could have been making when they were looking for black hole hair by doing perturbations to the ordinary black hole geometry and not finding any hair. The actual hair are not small perturbations of a metric like this. They actually seem to look more like this. Okay, so I think since today I'm out of time, I'm going to stop here, and next time I'm going to start talking about free charge.
So the factorization things, I have one question. This one, could you talk about this one in the other context of PP?